Me.
Hello there. You're about to listen to an interview with Irish playwright Marina Carr. The interview took place at the Federal University of Santa Catarina in Florianópolis, Brazil, in November 2017, as part of the second edition of our Irish Studies Symposium. My name is Aline Fernandez. I'm Senior Lecturer in English and Translation at the Federal University of Santa Catarina, and I hope you enjoyed this.
Exactly. I know I went through four drafts, and I know I delivered it to the theatre the day I delivered my first child. And it was a story about this thing, Pat Grace, the artistic director of the Abbey, who also directed by the first director by the Law of Cats. He loves to tell this story, so I get to tell it here. But because of the nature of the play, and those of you who've read it know it's based on Medea, and I was expecting my first child, who's traveling with me today, or here in Brazil, and there's no way, because I didn't know, nobody knows what it's like having a child until you have one. So I thought, if I don't get this play finished before I have this child, I'm never going to finish it again. So it was a desperate rush to get it finished, and just literally the same day. And because I don't think you could write a play like that with a newborn infant, certainly your first newborn infant in the house. To be quite talismanic about things like that. So that's my memory of it. And then what I remember is 6 months, basically, as all new mothers, you know, going around and peeing your hair and not washing, and, you know, this tiny infant, this little stranger appears, and just trying to figure that out. So the whole thing passed by me. So I used to go into rehearsals for the first production, and I literally go back home, and my mother-in-law would be sitting in the taxi with the baby, because I was feeding him myself. So I come out of rehearsals and feed, and then go back into rehearsals, etc., etc. So the whole thing's absolutely blurred for me. And what's really interesting about receptions and plays, I've always thought it takes a hell of a long time for a play to land. So you very kindly translated my play into Portuguese. So this is a celebration for Alina as well as for me today, because it's first out in Portuguese, or Brazilian Portuguese, so it's a big thing for both of us, actually. But I wouldn't be surprised if it disappeared for about 10 years and then will come back again. Because that has been my experience with plays I've written, not just by the Bog and Cat. Some of them land and some of them slip quietly away and come back again later. Mm-hmm. So it's a very long, long game.
Yeah. And then how or where would you place this amongst your most recent books?
It's kind of, well, I wrote these, I was very influenced by Samuel Beckett as a young writer. I discovered him in my third year at UCD, and I discovered him, and we have a 3-year BA program in UCD, or we had at the time. I discovered him in my final year. I was absolutely fascinated. I'd never read anything like him. So immediately I started writing absurdist plays. So my first four plays were so influenced by Beckett, and then I realized I'd written myself into a corner. That was, you know, Beckett pastiche was great fun. It was a great way to kind of cut your teeth with a yardstick like that, which I failed miserably. But I learned a lot. But in the learning, I attended the masters on Samuel Beckett, but I just kept playwriting, kept getting in the way, so I never finished it. But I finally realised I'd written myself into a corner. So then I started, well, what do I know about? So my daughter, I lived in Connemara. I wrote a play called The May, and then I wrote a play called Portia Coughlin, a play called On Rafter's Hill, and a play called By the Bog and Cats. So I suppose I'd all of those written by the time I was 32. Mm-hmm. So that's, I suppose they're, I don't know, phase, whatever they were. I was young enough when I wrote them. So, yeah. But for the writer, the best play is always the one you're writing, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's like, don't crucify me with my dog cats. I'll take certain responsibility for it, but not completely. And now that it's in Portuguese, it's all Aline's fault. She don't like it. It's not me, it's her.
Okay, well, okay, yeah. If it doesn't go well here, it's all my fault.
Yeah, absolutely.
How does it feel to see your works traveling to different countries and being performed in different languages?
I love to hear the work in different languages, because by the time it gets around to being translated, you'll have the gist of the plot, and maybe some of the lines will come back to you, but most of it you won't understand. So it's very interesting. Recently I saw a production of the play called Marble in Spanish, and I loved listening to it because it sounded fabulous. And then I saw the same play in Italian a few years previously, and I loved that as well. It just, those languages are so romantic, and anything sounds beautiful in Italian. And the actors were stunning, and it was a beautiful production, same with the Spanish production. So I love when I'm asked, and any opportunity to engage. And it's a strange sort of thing, when a play is written, it's gone from you. And then you get a little chance to revisit it if it's translated. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it's a nice bit of playwriting. Because when you're writing a play, you're desperate. And it's always disastrous until you've finished it. And very often when you finish it, it is actually really disastrous. Not just your fretting and your worrying around it. So for it to have the validation of translation is really a lovely, lovely thing.
I kind of feel the same in relation to the translation. I find the translation process so enjoyable.
Yeah.
And seeing the final product, it's a bit scary.
Yeah.
It's kind of like I want to go back to the start and do it all over again.
Yeah, because now you're going to be judged. Well, of course, the truth is we're all judged all the time.
All the time.
Yeah, but you can suspend it a little in the process.
You seem very open to the fact that once your work is out there, it's there to be read and interpreted in ways you haven't foreseen yourself. And that most certainly serves to reaffirm the power of your work, what you've just said, actually. Any thoughts on the fact that your play will be published in Brazil for the first time, specifically here?
Well,
any impressions?
You've got a big population, so it's quite a lot of royalties if it sells. Well, as I say, engaging with another culture, and I am, you know, absolutely new to this place, so I wouldn't have a clue where to begin to try and unpack what it is to be Brazilian and what my play might possibly mean. But listening to you earlier and the papers and the students and Ruth's paper on eco-gothic and bog gothic, I said, God, that's what I've been doing. I just didn't know that's what it was called. So it's always fascinating when you see things that align in different cultures and then things that are absolutely will never align, that they're just cultural phenomena and won't translate.
You often speak of how language, humour, dark humour, and the imagery created by metaphors are key, perhaps paramount, to your own work. As dark as Bogdan's is, it is also wonderfully witty and hilarious, in my opinion. I find it hilarious. Mrs. Kilbride is one of my favourite characters in the play, and possibly the one whose lines I enjoyed the most translating. And she reminded me of so many obsessive and controlling people in my own family, my grandmother especially. Could you comment on your creation of her character more specifically?
My grandmother as well. Well, the thing is, you take from everyone, and it's always really interesting. And I'm always asking other writers about this as well. And you write something, it's like everybody's lining up to say, that's about me, and she stole that from me, and that's my life, and blah, blah, blah. The truth is, when you're writing, you may take a detail from someone's life, but by the time you're finished, it is so transformed, it doesn't remotely resemble who it may have started out as. So it's a very, it's kind of a difficult one to gauge. I suppose, I was reading Swing Time, wonderful English novel, Swindon, Zadie Smith, an artist, and she was talking about the creative process, and she said, look, you just find the veil, whatever the veil is, just find the veil, you know, so you're not basically destroying everyone around you, your aunts, your uncles, or whoever's in your family or whatever. So you find the veil, but it must be a veil that allows you to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is just such important advice, that finally it is about telling the truth, of course with humour if you can, with darkness, with light, whatever. And to answer you about the humour thing, I've never actually attempted to write anything funny, because if I attempted a comedy, I would fall flat on my face.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's such humour inherent in the Irish psyche. It's something that kind of comes very easily to us. And I think this is what you're talking about, the play on language. We find that we get great fun out of that. And it's something I think nearly every Irish, maybe it's vanishing, but nearly every Irish person will at least have some memory of hearing that if they're not able to do that themselves. So I suppose what I'm saying is that we're still kind of eloquent around metaphor. In a culture that is largely about verb and adjective. So metaphor still has currency. And if you have metaphor, then you have humour. Patrick Cavan said tragedy is merely underdeveloped comedy. And there's a lot of truth in that. And Wilde talking about Salome, he said, what does it sound like? My tragedy is purple. So if you look at Wilde's comedies, they're hilarious. You look at his Salome, it is blacker. There's not one ounce of humour in it. I suppose, and it's kind of extraordinary for a writer who has such facility with metaphor that Salome is such a dark, dark piece. I don't know, somebody might argue with me and say there is humour to be found in Salome. I can't find any in Wilde Salome. But these comedies are magnificent. So it's, these kind of genres are breaking down as well. Tragedy, comedy, tragedy, Shakespeare famously just mixed them all together.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose life is tragic and life is a farce.
Mm-hmm.
It's both at the same time.
Yeah, I think that the moments, especially in the Act 2 of By the Wildcats, their moments are just so funny. And I think that those moments act as comic relief in the play. And I think that they actually heighten the tragedy of it.
Yeah.
Would you mind reading an excerpt from maybe Mrs. Kilbride's speech
sure.
at the wedding?
Yeah. Can you remember where that is? It's in Act 2.
Yeah.
I'll figure it out.
Probably find it.
So which one in particular do you want me to read? Her speech to her son?
Yeah.
Okay.
The one about the cross, the crucifixion.
Oh, the crucifixion.
Yeah.
Actually, this is one of my poor grandmother was dead and so on. But this is actually based, this speech is based on my brother. My grandmother lived up the north, and it was something we used to have to do when we were kids. It was called minding grandma. So there were six of us. So we sent off to my grandmother's house to mind her for like 4 months.
Oh.
And those were the days you'd put on a bus in Offaly and you'd arrive in the wilds of Killybegs like at 3 a.m. and the local parish priest would take pity on you and bring you up to your grandmother's house. It was that kind of thing. There was no like worrying, would she get on the right train or would she get off the wrong train? Like off you go, you're minding grandma. So my brother was minding and she's a religious maniac. And you don't get them much more religious than Donegal matriarchs. A tiny little woman, about 4 foot. But as they say, a targent. So it was my brother's turn to mind her. And she had us so demented with mass and polishing tombstones and communion and novenas that he was 7 at the time. And she looked after you really well and feed you and all that. She went to have a bath because it destroyed the eyes of the corpus, she believed. And she'd long grey hair down here. And she used to take the odd turn in the middle of the night, we won't talk about that. But she had my little brother so demented. She lived on a house on a hill. that one day he actually built Calvary for her on the hill. So he erected, hammered three crosses together and erected them on the hill. So that's where this, the inspiration for this particular speech. So I'll say no more. So this is at the, just to give you context, this is at the wedding of Mrs. Kilbride's son Carthage, who has left Hester and he's going to marry Carol Cassidy, who's the big farmer's daughter, and they're at the wedding. And Xavier Cassidy, the big farmer, has just made his, you know, these speeches, Irish people make at weddings, go on forever, so he made his speech. And everybody doesn't want Mrs. Kilbride to speak, the mother of the groom, but she's determined to speak, so she says, "As the proud mother of the groom, if you've been able to answer Xavier's fine speech with a few words in your own. Never was a mother more blessed than me in having Carthage for a son. As a child, he was uncommon good, never cried, never disobeyed, never raised voice once to me. Never went about with a grumpy puzzle. Indeed, he went to the greatest pains always to see that his spirits was good and his heart was uplifted. When his father died, he used to come into the bed to stay beside me for fear I would be lonely. Often I woke from deep slumber, his two arms would be round me, small neck thrown over me in sleep. He was also always aware of my abiding love for our Lord, like some here. And on one occasion, my birthday it was, I looked out the window, and there he was on the slope behind our house. And what was he doing? He was building Calvary for me. He'd hammered three wooden crosses and was erecting them on the slope, Calvary style. One for him, one for me, one for our Lord. And we draped ourselves around them like the two peas in the holy book. Remember Carthage." And then Carthage says, "I do not. Would you ever sit down?" Mrs. Kilbride, "Of course you do. The three crosses he made up on the slope. And remember the wind was howling and the pair was yelling, Calvary, Calvary to one another. Of course you remember. I'm only telling you this story as one of the countless examples of Carthage's kind nature. And I only want to say that Caroline is very welcome into the Kilbride household. And that Carthage would be as good a son to Caroline as he's been a husband to me, and she had no complaints." Cheers.
So that's her wedding speech.
Thank you so much for that. I just need to let you know that I had to add a footnote to this passage where it says, "If Carthage will be as good as a son to Caroline as he's been a husband to me," because everyone thought I got this line wrong.
Yeah.
I was like, no, this is what she means. You know, it is a Freudian slip. It really is.
Oedipus.
Exactly.
God, yes.
I had to add a footnote there and explain that this is correct.
Yeah.
This is what she is saying, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Moving on to my next question. Throughout your career, you seem to have always turned to the ancient Greece for inspiration. Your most recent plays are reimaginings or adaptations of classical works, such as Hecuba and Phaedra Backwards. Do you feel you've distanced yourself from the Irish landscape and folklore? Why? Also,
no, because this is the one of the things. When I wrote By the Bog of Cats, I love saying, all the reviews, not one of them twinkled, was based in Medea, which I think is extraordinary. So you have all these theatre reviewers who don't know their theatre. So I say this and they go mad. And say, of course they knew, but you can look at the documentation that they didn't know. So now, any play I write, they say it's based on the Greeks. So it's just covering all the bases. And the truth is that I write both stuff that is taken from Greek mythology or riffs on some of the plays, but I also just write plays that are not at all influenced, but for some reason everything I write now is Greek. So I hope that clears that up in Brazil at least. So I mean I'm an Irish writer, and even if you're writing something that's based on a Greek myth, I mean it's about finding the connection and what it means now. And here, or wherever here is. So I think I'm very tied to, but even if you don't set it in the landscape, even if landscape is not the paramount thing, and I do write plays where landscape is not the paramount thing, you're instantly, you're a giveaway. Hiberno English is a giveaway. The way Irish writers write, we use Hiberno English. So you read three sentences and anywhere in the world you'd say that's an Irish writer. It's not Indian English, it's not American English, it's not Canadian English, it's not Scottish English, it is Hiberno English. And I think if anything, why it has such attraction for people is because what I was saying earlier, it still deals, the Irish is still bubbling underneath the construction of the sentences, and very often in some of the words. So it makes for very, if you invert things, or if you have a roundabout way of saying things, you know, you're halfway there towards your lyric. So it's not like a hamburger, it's not like give, it's not like take, it's like where, how will I put this? It's like a slow, backwards, lazy way of approaching the sentence that is very particular to where, and I know all that's changed with social media and the globalization and whatever that means, I don't know what that means, where everyone talks about actually what it means. But you probably know what it means. But this kind of dumbing down and making everything the same. So,
still in relation to your latest plays, how was the experience of adapting Tolstoy's monumental novel Anna Karenina to the theatre stage? What motivated you to do so?
It's a long story, and royalties, shall we say. Look, I won't go into the politics of it, but
please do.
Well, no, it's like, look, you were listing out some of the plays. I just write plays all the time, and some of them get put on, some of them don't. So, Fiat Mockney, the former artistic director of the Abbey Theatre, came to me and asked me, would I do something for the Christmas last year? And it's going to be a long one on the main stage of the Abbey, which is around 500 seats, it was only an 8-week run, and they had to make money. So I said, look, I have all these plays written. He said, no, your plays wouldn't fill the Abbey for 8 weeks, which I disagree with. But so he said, would you do an adaptation? And fair enough, it is Christmas. And I don't know what it's like here, but Christmas at home, people who never go to the theatre will go and see a show. It's like I'm going to take the whole family if they can, they're on their holidays, and it's just in the budget, it's a thing to do with grandmothers and grandparents and bring their grandkids and everything. So it needed to be something that would have a wide appeal, and it needed to be something that I wanted to do. So I've always loved Anna Karenina, I love Tolstoy. It took me, I was 49 when I finally read War and Peace. I literally got into bed and said, I'm not getting out of bed until I finish War and Peace. And I was so ashamed to be that old when I read it. So, but I've always been reading Anna Karenina. So every decade I've read it. So he said, we decided finally, okay, I'll do Anna Karenina. And 900 pages. And my first draft was 6.5 hours. And they all said, no, can't have that. Because nobody would come. It's a Christmas show, so it has to be made at 3.5 hours with interval. So we cut to ribbons. And the final version is 3 hours. But I was working with a wonderful director, and it worked. We actually got away with it. By the skin of our teeth, we got away with it. And I know people who love the book will have quibbles because, you know, it's a big, dense, beautiful book, and a very complex book. But we did the best we could. I still have this little idea that I would love to see the 6.5 hour version. I don't know if we'll ever see the light of day. And I learned a lot doing it, because the thing is, when you do an adaptation, a lot of what I do is not adaptation. People mistake it for adaptation, but it's not. Like, for example, Hecuba is not an adaptation of Euripides' Hecuba. It is my response to Euripides' Hecuba and to the mythology around Hecuba. But in the case of Anna Karenina, I felt I was the craft person here. So it was not about me or my ego or what I wanted to do. It was about serving Tolstoy's beautiful novel and trying to make it work on the stage. So that was a huge learning curve. how to do that. It's quite difficult actually to put prose on stage. So you have to work around it. Exactly what you were talking about earlier, some of it will fly and some of it won't. It has to unfold as the audience are watching, otherwise it becomes something that happened ages ago.
And do you test the language with actors before you finalise the version that is used on stage?
In that case, because there were so many cuts, it wasn't so much testing, it was trying to get, it was watching the clock and cutting. I don't know what theatre is like here in Brazil, if you're into the workshops and workshopping plays and all of that, I absolutely hate all of that, because I came up the old way, where you wrote your play, you redrafted it, you got it as good as you could, you sent it off, and the theatre wrote back to you and said yes or no. Now, you go in and you have these, I don't know if it's the way here, but you have these literary departments, and it's all about theatre making. So everything, it's jack of all trades. So sometimes it works. It works, I mean, film is completely alternative as director. The director is usually the writer, the director has the final cut, the director has the final edit of the script, it can rewrite the script. And it's becoming like that in theatre, and I think to its detriment. So you have all the coots, but where's the writing, where's the voice? Where is the thing we want? Where is the thing that we love in writers that we love? Where is that quality? And that's always the lone voice, and it's all in the best stuff, it's always the outsider voice. And if you mix and mess with that, you're going to get something really bland with all the edges of it. You know, that's this thing in identifying forgeries in painting, isn't it? It's by the flow when you tell a masterpiece. Is that how they identify the real thing from the copy? So I don't know what your practice is in Brazil. Is it like it is in the rest of, well, the American model, which has been adopted by Europe, and which Ireland has adopted, and it's what we're working on now. I have huge problems with that.
Yeah.
So I don't know, what is it like that here?
I think we do the jack of all trades here as well.
Yeah.
Especially because we don't really have as many positions in the theatre as there are in Europe, for instance. You have, whenever you have a dramaturge, theatre director,
yeah.
Very often the translator is the director, him or herself,
yeah.
And the dramaturge, so you know, you cover all bases.
Yeah, well, I can see that actually, out of necessity, I can see that. I think that's fine when you're cutting your teeth. As a young writer, young director, young actor, whatever it is, you have to make the work and make it wherever you can. Where I have problems with it is the big producing houses. And the last thing they want out of you is a play. They want an idea. They want creative investment from themselves at a very, very early stage. It's not a situation where you go off and write the play and then we produce it and we like in a direction and get great actors and we do it. We're going to make sure, because the money is so much, I suppose, and I understand it financially, but creatively it is death for playwriting.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be absolutely perfect,
yeah.
And it has to be their idea of perfection before it will ever make the stage. And the truth is, most new plays now, they're done in little experimental spaces, they're very short runs, very few people come to see them, and they die a death. Or even worse again, they are workshopped to death, and they never even writer. Lots of writers the generation below me, because of the whole crash, have never had professional productions of their plays because of the money thing. And maybe it's similar here.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a whole generation of theatre makers, and the reason they are a jack of all trades is because nobody supported them when they should have been supported. So now they have lost a decade. And I don't know, maybe I'm old-fashioned. I think they need to be looked after, and they need to be taken in. And I think respect for each person's role within what is a collaborative process.
Mm-hmm.
I think people who mistake collaboration with doing everyone else's job.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Absolutely. In your rewriting of Anna Karenina, did you base your version, your play version of the novel in any specific translation that you can recall? Did you consult different translations?
I had 6 or 7 of them on the go, and I can't remember one of them. That was I kept going back to Constance Garnett, because she's so, she makes a lot of it up. But she's the best, and then there's the couple who do it, and then there was, I've forgotten, there's 3 or 4 of them I was working on. I forget the names once I've done them. Yeah, all the recent ones and Constance Garnett, because something very stately about her, and it's nearer to the time Tolstoy wrote the book than any of the more recent ones. So, yeah. And then I put, it was written in Hibernian English, the adaptation. It wasn't attempting to be. And actually, one of the criticisms, the very few criticisms, strangely enough, usually I get savage, but the really big criticism of it was that it was done in Irish accents. So it's like, what? Are we meant to speak in, are we meant to do it in Finnish Russian?
Yeah.
Are we meant to do it in English Russian accents?
Yeah.
It's like, what is your point here?
Yeah.
And like, what is wrong
yeah.
with the Irish accent doing Anna Karenina?
Yeah.
It's like, what is wrong with Portuguese accent doing Hamlet?
You can do it in Russian anyway.
Well,
yeah. So.
This is Brian Field's criticism to many of the translation of many of Chekhov's plays as well. They all sound very English. Why not have an Irish version of Chekhov's plays?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Because when you read into Russian literature, now I know a bit about Chekhov, I know a bit about Tolstoy, but you realise that the whole Russian social setup was so different from the upstairs, downstairs of the English world. So you get these terrible, very English translations of Tolstoy and Chekhov and a lot of the Russians. And it was more actually, the way they lived on their estates was more like the Irish way.
Mm.
The peasants and the serfs, they were all lumped in together, and the nanny slept beside the child who's 85, who's been minded the child since, forever, and the servants were part of the family, and that kind of obsession around vodka and loneliness and suicidal, it's very easy for the Irish psyche, I think, to wrap itself around a lot of Russian literature.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to change the subject a bit, and then we'll go back to your collaboration in the theatre in Iran. Could you tell us a bit about your work as a lecturer at Dublin City University? Which courses do you teach? How do you conciliate your multifaceted professional life as lecturer and writer in residence and playwright?
With great difficulty. I'm very fortunate. They've been very good to me. So it's my 4th year in the School of English at Dublin City University, and it's a new amalgamation of St. Patrick's College where I started. It was all now DCU, it's a growing school. So when I started, I was kind of jack of all trades, they're stuck. So yeah, we need a lecture on Waiting for God or Endgame, can you do that on Tuesday morning? So I'd be filling in around other people's modules, stuff like that. But my main brief was creative writing. So for undergraduates, we don't have a master's program in creative writing yet. We are currently trying to set up one, and we hope it will be up and running by September. So I suppose that's one of the reasons I'm there, because I'm not an academic. They don't want me for my academic credentials. They want me as a working writer. And for that reason, they're very good to me around time and the amount of hours I have to do. If they can give me time off and all, they do. Because, as I say, they've fulfilled their brief within the department for each specialism. And I'm supposed to be the creative writing person and help them set up the master's program in creative writing while continuing to teach it at an undergraduate level.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the students, they're a great bunch. Some of them are madly passionate into writing. Some of them are trying for the first time. Because we're just trying to get off the ground, I'm kind of I suppose I'm jack of all trades. I'm teaching fiction or writing. Some of them want to write fiction, some of them want to write poetry. I don't write poetry, I don't write fiction. This year, strangely enough, my 2nd year is, and I've got 20 of them, 21 of them actually. not one of them are interested in writing plays. So we're just floundering along together. I mean, obviously I read a lot of prose, and I know a good line or a good paragraph when I see one. But in terms of how useful I am to them, well, it's not what I'm trained in.
Yeah.
Whereas I could, if the 21 of them wanted to write a play, I'd have a fairly good idea of how to go about,
yeah,
you know, getting them there.
Mm.
And so the irony is you can't really teach anyone to write,
mm-hmm,
but you can teach them how to read, and to read like a writer, which is a very different way of, you know, reading for pleasure or reading, let's say, to write an academic essay. So reading with that kind of savage, voracious, acquisitive magpie,
yeah,
side of one's brain and heart and soul, which is the way writers read. And anybody who tells you otherwise is a liar. That's the way writers read. And so the whole history of writing is rewriting.
Yeah.
It's rewriting all the way back, passing down the stories, coming out of your own tradition, coming out of song,
mm-hmm,
and then beginning to be written down. And then one's engagement. And one's, very often, rewriting tends to incorporate one's misunderstanding of someone else's text, which is always interesting. So that's what I want.
Do you feel that teaching has made you more conscious of your own creative process as a writer, or has it affected you in some way in your career as a writer?
I think it's always good to be talking about what you do, and my students are great because it's all new to them. They don't have any status anxiety around being the next greatest novelist yet. I wish actually some of them would. And have that kind of arrogance and, you know, that kind of bolshy quality you need to get your first book out as a young writer or your first play or whatever it is. But I love being around them. And the way I look at it is we kind of learn together, because as a writer you don't really have any answers, you have questions. And each time you sit down to write a play, okay, you learn a few technical things. But the few things you've learned for the last thing you know may not necessarily apply for the next thing you're writing. So there's no by rote. And the minute it becomes by rote, it's kind of dead writing, and it's not going to interest anyone, least of all the writer. So it's that kind of element of constantly surprising yourself, and that kind of, you know, making it up on the hoof, and just taking the risk and the chance, and seeing where the line will take you. So it takes kind of extraordinary faith action in oneself, and just in the language, and the powers of imagination. Enormously helped as well, of course. The more you read, the better writer you will be. There's absolutely no doubt. There's absolutely no doubt. I think for a young writer, that doesn't matter. You get your first one or two out just on sheer chutzpah and picking out what's in the air. And particularly if you are in an English BA program, you'll have got a taster of things.
Mm-hmm.
So you begin to position your what's connecting with you.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to do this idealistically or ideologically or consciously, but it's happening.
Yeah.
Your relationship with language.
Yeah. This is going to get more political. As artists and academics in the arts and the humanities, it is impossible not to turn our attention to the current worldwide sweep of far-right movements and the transnational humanitarian crisis. What do you think is the role of the artist in relation to the current political climate?
Mm.
Do you see any words on that?
Well, who was it said all art is useless? I forget. Bruce, who said all art is useless?
W. Jordan said, if Paul makes nothing happen, that's an useless.
Yeah, it's sort of the same kind of thing, isn't it? I don't know. I often think the writer's job is to write the thing, and other people will come along and tell you what it means. But then there are all different types of writing, you know, there are glimpses, and there are, because the way I like to describe, there are poets of the theatre, there are prose writers of the theatre. Or as Truman Capote said, there are writers and there are tap writers. So I don't know where I'm not a political animal. I tend to avoid all of that. I spent 9 years in Kerry, and I used to order 3 newspapers a day because I was terrified because I was living in the middle of nowhere that I'd miss anything. And after about a year, I realised the locations changed and the stories were pretty much the same, the photographs were the same. Which is really just another way of saying that human nature has not really changed since the old stories were first laid down, like the myths and the legends. And that's enough for me. If I desperately need to know something, I'll ask my husband, because he loves politics and all that. He'll give me 5 minutes for idiot version, just enough so I don't. Well, I usually do fall flat on my face when I'm into politics, which is one of the reasons why I tend to keep away from it. I'm not exactly sure the writer has a role within that. And I know the little bit I do know about Latin America is that a lot of writers have been quite involved politically. And I don't know enough to comment on that. And again, at home, you look at the founding of art theatre, look at Yeats, look at Lady Gregory, look how politically active they were. And, you know, you look at MacDonald, a lot of the 1916 guys in the shop, they had all them writers, they were poets and playwrights. So where do I fit in with that? And thanks to them, I live in a republic and not a colony, you know, in a mad sort of way. So one does owe something, but I think you have to have a gift for it, and you also need to know what you're talking about, because I think you can do a lot of damage otherwise. Because I don't know if it's changing, but I suppose people, rightly or wrongly, people look to the bards for advice or guidance, and I think maybe that's got confused with looking to the poet or the playwright or the novelist. Or commentary should really should be looked to the work, because I think the writer is as flawed and as wrong-headed as anyone else, and they're, you know, none deserve messiahs. And I think there is a bit of a culture of the male messiah, which is dying very fast, and the quicker the better, I would say. Because I think there's been too much pressure for too long on these people to deliver this kind of stuff that's actually not their kin. And denying then too much of the other half of the population of the world. So, yeah.
In the past, how much time do we have? How much time do we have? 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Oh my goodness,
I've got people get tired, even of me.
It's okay, let me see here in a second. Okay, well, one final question then.
A few years ago, this is to conclude, you were interviewed by Maria Cordy, a Hungarian professor at University of Pécs. At that time, you spoke of how, at the beginning of your career as a playwright, you were stretching your limbs. That your first plays were exercises that dealt with an understanding of living and dying, all the big things. As you read more, as you read more and felt more mature, you turned to the region where you came from, the Irish Midlands, and you also spoke then about how you would feel humbled and afraid to write in the face of everything that had been done before you. How do you see yourself as a writer now? What are your main concerns? How do you feel in relation to the previous generations of writers, playwrights, both in Ireland and abroad, thinking of your great inspirations? Do you feel you've found your own voice, if that means anything, especially in theatre and intrinsically public form of art?
God, there's a lot in that.
I'm sorry.
Where do I start? Have I found my own voice? Mm-hmm. That's a big one. I think I might have hit a couple of things. I think I need to do a hell of a lot more. You know, what you're working on, you always hope you're getting better and better. This is not very often the case, because it's one step forward and 10 back a lot of the time. It's very interesting, from having been the youngest person in the room to suddenly realising you're one of the oldest, if not the oldest person in the room. And that happened very quickly. I don't think I track that, and that's kind of interesting, and particularly at home, because we've had a whole generation of the big guys, so I would be kind of the second crowd coming along. I now find myself, well, there's nothing between me and eternity now. You know, you're coming to the top of the mountain, and, you know, it's very quick down the other side. So there's an element of that. I suppose if I was being completely honest, I would consider myself mid-career, although I hate talking about careers in terms of playwriting. If that's an honest, to answer you honestly, I think I've achieved some things, but I think I have a lot more to achieve. Mm-hmm. And I do feel largely that my apprenticeship is over now, but just about. Mm-hmm. So that's how I feel.
Thank you. And I have one final question. Do you like coffee?
I love coffee. I love coffee.
Beans. So, where's it gone?
Where's it gone?
I got you a package of roasted coffee beans from the region of Minas Gerais, which is where my head is from. And that's where our best coffee comes from.
Oh, sorry. Thank you so much. Thank you.
That will keep you going for a while.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you guys for being here. And on to the local.
Yes.
No?
Get through.
Yeah, we do.